Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
I'm still convinced that kittens have, like, alien DNA in them.
Mom, I don't care. I'll eat lunch later.
Was he come get me?
By the way, come get me.
Hey now.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I'm a professional blogger.
Come on, Kyle. Eat the sandwich. You're wasting away to nothing. Eat a piece of chicken, Kyle.
This is a sickness. This is an illness. I'm infected.
Hello, nurse.
Debate hockey.
What a cute little puppy. Oh, he's going to grow up to be a big, strong dog who challenges for the Stanley Cup.
How about, will you, like, give your head a shake? Look at the history of these two teams.
Give me a break. They had a 3-goal lead in Game 7.
You're a tough guy, I guess. That's it.
I'm not
You're a tough guy.
Pop culture.
I'm down with OPP.
Did you ever find it weird that Fonz's office was a crapper?
I'm trying to find time to film myself eating a cupcake.
And more hockey.
Oh, you took a puck to the face and your teeth all melted. You got a concussion. Well, I died.
I'd agree with you if you were right.
F you.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Let's start the show correctly. Rightly.
Rightly.
Start the show proper, shall we?
So round one of Patty versus Austin goes to Patrick Laine. Patrick Laine wins round one.
The rivalry where the players play against each other exactly twice a year.
I saw Dan Rosen at the Rangers Red Wings game. Dan Rosen of NHL.com. And I turned to him and I said, "So are you guys just gonna take all the templates that you have for Sid versus Ovi and just plug in Matthews and Laine going forward?"
It's so strange because I've maintained the bigger, not that it's a rivalry, but the comparison point may end up being McDavid versus Matthews. They'll only meet twice a year. And if you want to ratchet up what happened last night at MTS, Laine versus Matthews, they meet exactly twice a year. Maybe the biggest rivalry when you're focusing on Austin Matthews, if you're a Maple Leafs fan, is Austin Matthews versus Jack Eichel.
Jack Eichel,
and
yeah.
We're not seeing it because Jack Eichel is injured. But there were plenty of people, and wish you were there. I mean, how many people at the draft 2 years ago, when you asked if Austin Matthews were available for the draft this year, this is the Florida draft, where would he go? There were plenty that said number two above Eichel. Like, the majority said Jack Eichel, but there still was that comparison. I wonder if that is not, and this might just be the hipster pick, who knows. I wonder if not that may end up being, considering they're going to play each other more than twice a year, I wonder if that may just end up being the bigger rivalry if you're a Maple Leafs fan looking for someone to key in on either McDavid or Laine. It'll probably be Eichel.
It's weird how Eichel all of a sudden became the odd man out in all these rivalries. Like,
I know.
Austin Matthews and Connor McDavid are, you know, Blur and Oasis, and Eichel is like Pulp. He's just over on the side. Which makes Patrick Laine Elastica, I guess. I don't know. But, yeah, it is sort of weird how that happened.
This just must be burning him so much. Like, if I'm Jack Eichel, I can't stand this. Like, this is driving me nuts. You know, big year last year, 20 goals, looking to take the next step, play on a big line with the Buffalo Sabres, going to get big minutes, injured in practice. Going to be gone for a while. Knowing how competitive that guy is, and even as hockey fans, man, we got ripped off, because you're right, Wish. There should be someone else in this conversation. It should just be, wow, look at McDavid. He's so fast. Who can catch him? Wow, Patrick Laine snapping in 3 goals, like breaking sticks. Wow, Austin Matthews, 4 goals against the Ottawa Senators. You know, part of this equation has got to be Jack Eichel. And it will be Jack Eichel when he comes back. But right now, he's just got to be seething. I really hope, to your point about Dan Rosen, that everybody at NHL.com makes a big deal when Eichel comes back. Because he's got to be one of those guys in that conversation.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. But again, as we talked about earlier this season, the big news is that we have all of these new pieces on the chessboard that we actually care about. These guys, Austin Matthews, Connor McDavid, I would group in Johnny Gaudreau in this.
Yep.
I would group in Gossesbear in this. The PK Subban dream of the name on the back being more important than the logo on the front could come to fruition in some of these cases with these kids.
Got no problem with it. I know there's going to be a lot of vets that have, you know, that suck a lemon about it, that are sour about it, but too bad. That's the new reality of sports. Oh, imagine that. Players that want to be creative. Oh, wow. Imagine that. Players that you know, want to go out there and try things and don't just want to play table hockey with their positions up and down and up and down and stay in your lane. Oh, my God, guys that want to, like, actually have some hockey joy when they make a big play. How about that? Instead of, you know, coming back to the bench and looking like that grumpy cat meme that we've been seeing on the internet for how many years. Imagine that. Wow. Enjoying sports. Wow. Enjoying taking some joy out of it, taking some joy out of being creative, enjoying yourself when you make a big play or score a goal. How about this one? And this is the one that burns the old school guys more than anything else. Not being deathly upset when you lose and not wearing it in the room afterwards. Being able to function after a loss. Like, it must be because, listen, hockey seasons are long. Hockey careers can be long as well. You can't live and die every single win and loss. But I'm sure a lot of these guys must feel like actors in that they must feel phony in that they have to go through a little act in the dressing room after a loss and pretend like their dog just got put down because that's what the media expects and that's what fans expect. You can't just be, oh, well, we move on to the next game. You have to wear it until you leave the rink and you finally say, are the cameras off? Can I, like, enjoy myself and say it was only one game out of 82? Like, most guys, I would be – on the one hand, I think I'd have a lot of fun with media if I played in the NHL.
Yeah, I often think about that.
I think fans might hate me because I don't think that I would wear losses the way that fans would want me to wear a loss. Like, it's, you know, my great aunt who helped raise me just passed away, or my dog's lost, or my cat got his head chopped off in Stouffville. Like, I'm sorry, I can't. I wouldn't be able to do it. Would you be able to do it? Losses like that consistently?
No, but I would go in the opposite direction. I think if I was going to, I've often thought about this, by the way, because it's just like how I have no athletic ability, but often thought about if I were a professional wrestler, how I'd be. Like, I often think about, despite having no athletic ability, what it would be like to be a professional athlete and be on the other side of the table on these media conversations. And I've come to the conclusion that after losses, I think I'd be sort of like a Trump surrogate after he loses a debate where I'm like unwaveringly sunny about my prospects and constantly deferring blame. Like, I think if it was like, Greg, tell us about the loss tonight. What did we really lose besides our democracy in this moment? I think what we all saw out there is not losing today, but gaining the opportunity for tomorrow.
That's right. Two sides of every mountain, the shady side, the sunny side.
That's
right.
You
know what I would be like? I would just mess around with guys. Like, if Reporter X from sports radio station, whatever, put a microphone in my face to ask about how embarrassing our power play is, you know, for the last 27, I'd say, yeah, we're pretty bad. Hey, I saw the ratings for your radio station. You guys are really sucking. What are you going to do about that? I'm dying for a player to serve the table. And just saying, yeah, man, like, you got no viewers. Like, what gives with that? Hey, how many Twitter followers do you have? Really? That's it? What are you going to do about that? You're not really doing your job, are you?
Like, if the TSN microphone flag was the only one in front of me, I'd be like, yes, as I was saying on Sportsnet 590 the other day.
Yeah. Doesn't exist. I know.
You and I both are obviously coming at this from a sort of a media savvy standpoint, but do you ever worry that if you were that good to be in the league that you'd be able to not be the controversial quote guy, or do you think that at the end of the day you couldn't help but be like Brad Marchand at some point?
Yeah, there's a few that slip through. I think there's this sort of, you know, there's this grinder that you go through, and then out at the other end comes this hockey player who's armed with cliches, and that's just the way it's going to be. And I always go back and forth. Like, I've been able to, much like you, sort of keep an ironic distance away from the sport and have that perspective. You know,
right.
Mike Myers gave a great quote to Letterman once when Dave Letterman said, you know, why is it that per capita, Mike, you know, Canadians just produce so many comedians, like, if whether it's in film, whether it's stand-up, like, Canada produces funny people. The country just does, per capita. It's ridiculous. And I thought Mike Myers, one of the only things that I've ever taken of value that Mike Myers has ever said, you know, brought up a really interesting point. He said, look, this is a situation. Americans watch television, but Canadians watch American television.
Right.
So there's that ironic distance. There's that one layer, that sort of, that critical layer that sort of allows you to sort of hover above the event itself. That I think when it comes to hockey, you, me, and anyone probably listening to this podcast right now have been able to hover above. So you have that greater perspective. You're able to laugh at yourself. You're able to laugh at it. But I do wonder if I'd gone through this entire, you know, this entire assembly line and come out at the other end after starting when I was 4 years old and come out at the other end at 18 in the NHL, if I would really ever have that ironic distance. Because it would just be me in the middle of hockey having things pounded into me, whether it's how you play positionally, how you dress, or what you say after a win, or more importantly, for some people, satisfaction and their ability to put their head on a pillow, what you say after a loss. I don't really know the answer, Wish.
I don't know either, and I worry what I would say after a win.
You'd be the worst.
Like, oh, I would.
It's game four. You'd be the guy carrying. You would pick up the garbage can in the dressing room and parade around like it's a Stanley Cup and nothing more than your jockstrap and a smile and a cigar.
Not only that, but it's
game four and you just beat Columbus.
Yeah, I would bury my opponents. I would do more grave dancing than Soul Asylum in that locker room with the post game interviews.
That's right.
All right, listen. I want to talk about the Penguin situation with you. Matt Murray signs a 3-year extension and kicks in next year for $3.75 million per season. We know what their situation is. Do you think Fleury lasts the season, or do you think he gets traded before the deadline this year?
I guess it all depends on the injury. Here's the thing, though. If the Pittsburgh Penguins are still in go-for-it mode, I know you won with Matt Murray last year, but who do you think is a better goaltender?
Yeah, that's – well,
I'll take Marc-Andre Fleury in that fight.
Yeah.
I really will.
I tend to believe you, and I think that the team played really well in front of Murray. I thought Murray had some really good moments in the playoffs, but ultimately I think you have to err on the side that of the guy who's done it for 60 games in the NHL, and Murray hasn't done it yet.
Look what the Pittsburgh Penguins are able to do to the San Jose Sharks, right? The possession monsters, you know, this ability to get in the offensive zone and set up like no other team. They were able to slow down the San Jose Sharks in the neutral zone last year, never allowed them to get, you know, zone entries that they wanted. And that allowed players like Brian Dumoulin to look like Paul Coffey. And that disallowed the San Jose Sharks from playing their game. And that was Matt Murray. I'm not taking anything away from Matt Murray. I thought he was excellent last year in the playoffs. Totally on board with Matt Murray. But if you put a gun to my head and say, who's your goalie you want in net right now? Pick one, Fleury or Murray? I'm taking Flower. I really am. I still think he's a better goaltender.
Yeah, and if you wanna believe that the window of opportunity is still wide open for him, which it obviously is,
considering
what conference they're in, then you do yourself a favor, I think, by keeping him on the roster and keeping both goalies there, and then deciding in the offseason what you need to do. And here's the thing about it too. It's not as if there's not going to be a market for a guy who can play 60 games, who's a proven starter in the league, who has at least 2 years left on his contract. I mean, it's not as if there's not going to be somebody out there that's like, oh yeah, by the way, we could probably use a guy like that instead of our two-headed monster of completely average goalies. Neither of them can ever be an established starter in this league. Dallas.
Pause. Dallas.
Yeah.
Just like an instant punchline. Just like saying Saskatchewan. It's just funny when you say it. Pause. Saskatchewan. hey, is Derek Fouliot in tonight? Do you know that?
I don't know yet.
With Letang injured? Okay. Try to find that out. I think he is.
And I also don't know what Sid's deal is. And the latest we heard from Chicago is that Brian Campbell's going to be a healthy scratch.
I saw that.
So that's kind of interesting.
What gives? Come on. Now, not that I'm a big fan of the Iron Man streak, because you know how I feel about that. Mm-hmm. But I can't remember the last time Brian Campbell didn't play a game.
I think his last healthy scratch was actually back when he was with the Blackhawks. So there's that.
Oof.
By the way, speaking of defensemen, for all of you worried about what the Guy Boucher effect may do for Erik Karlsson, he only has 7 points in 4 games. So,
yeah. And did you see that empty netter the other day when he blocked the shot?
Uh-huh.
Protecting, yeah.
Well, I mean, no, listen. He already lost to Norris in game one when Matthews danced by him. So forget that.
Yeah, right. Never mind the fact that, you know, him and Kyle Turris absolutely gobbled up Matthews in the 3-on-3. But let's just look the other way because, look, someone lifted his stick.
That's right. I was at Detroit and the Rangers last night watching the Jimmy Howard show.
He was great.
He was fantastic last night. But the Rangers were also a team that I felt like they generated a crap ton of chances, but were just kind of a tick off from where they should be on their timing. But he was good though. I can't deny him that win. And Detroit played pretty well, and Lundqvist did not play pretty well in that one gaffe behind his own net that resulted in the game winner. But I don't know. You know, I like a lot from what I see with the Rangers so far. That Kreider-Nash Zibanejad line looks legit, and they look good. I like the way they look right now.
Were we on the air when the Broussard Zibanejad deal happened?
I don't remember.
I want to say that we were, because this was one that, you know, as much as at the end of the season we looked at the Rangers and said, man, they are dead, so it's going to take a long time to crawl out from under the weight of what's gone on there. Man, Zibanejad trade was excellent for them. And I know you got to pay the guy next year. He's a restricted free agent. But still, I thought that was a great shot of youth and a high-quality player who's now finally, like, if you finally filled out his frame. If you go look at Mika Zibanejad like 2 years ago, doesn't he look like a completely different hockey player?
Oh, sure.
Like, he's like a stick and teeth. That's it. He's a hockey stick and teeth with a jersey over him. But now he's like, he's got an NHL body. He's got NHL size, quality player. I still do have the same concerns that everybody does. That blue line.
Well, yeah.
Oy, yoy, yoy, yoy.
But as you know, listen, there are a few time-honored traditions in the National Hockey League. You need a French-speaking coach in Montreal. You need to have a big shot defenseman on your power play. And also, great goaltending overcomes faulty blue line every time.
Have you watched the Maple Leafs this year, sir?
Well, what? They don't have a good blue line or good goaltending this year.
That's the bad combination.
Yeah, we've seen across this league average to mediocre defense and being propped up by great goaltending, and the Rangers could do the same thing this year.
One of the funniest phone calls I got last night. So I'm about to go to bed. I get a phone call from a buddy of mine that has a sports bar in Toronto, and he calls me up and he's steaming mad, and he's like, "Did you watch that game tonight?" And I said, "Yeah, of course." He goes, "Did you see that goaltending?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "What are they doing with that goaltender? Don't they know I have a sports bar to run? What are they doing with that goaltender? There's no way I'm going to fill my place if that's the goaltender."
Wow.
How can I run a sports bar in Toronto if that's the goaltender?
I hope this individual shows up at whatever, like, Brendan Shanahan town meeting happens at some point in Toronto. Steps up to the mic and asks that question.
It's funny because that does underscore one reality of money in Toronto. There is a decent percentage of Toronto's economy tied up in that hockey team. And when that hockey team is doing well, everyone in the city is spending money, and they are going out, and it is great. And when they ain't playing well, all that money goes away for all those people. Thank you very much. And the sports bars feel it.
Indeed. Lastly, I'll make it an admission. I will make a mea culpa.
What's
a lot of people are always wondering what happens in the press box, whether there's cheering or rooting or what we're doing during the game. And I will freely admit that myself and an unnamed other member of the media next to whom I was sitting last night may have been watching Detroit's victory over the New York Rangers whilst listening to the third and final presidential debate on our headphones.
Had it on Twitter. Watched it on Twitter. I'm addicted to watching everything on Twitter now.
I gotta admit, that's actually where I wasn't watching it. I was watching the game, freely admit that. Didn't need to see it. Don't need to see those two individuals much more than I already do. But I was listening to the audio while watching the game. And it was really, I was getting some messages from people that were following me on Twitter last night. They're like, You know, it's kind of funny how, like, one minute you're like, you know, Trump's not going to concede the election, and then hell of a save there by Howard. It's like,
but you know what that would be? That would be like you after the game. I guess going back to the original point about you being a player, like, when would you ever concede a loss? Oh, sure, I guess the scoreboard says we lost it, but, you know, fix was in. I'm not going to concede that game. That's not a 7-4 game.
Well,
that
brings me to one of my single favorite moments in the history of stand-up comedy, and I want to say it was a guy named Jeff Stiltson or something like that that did the bit. The bit where he's talking about religious athletes and, you know, how they're always crediting God and Jesus for their victories.
Yeah.
And he's just like, just once I'd love to see someone go the other way and blame them for a loss. Yeah, everything was going so great until Jesus made me fumble.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, God really stuck it to me last night. Thanks, JC. Appreciate it. Peace out. My favorite bit of presidential humor, I think it was Bill Burr who did the bit. The great, great, great Bill Burr, who said, you know, it doesn't really matter. I hope it's Bill Burr, because if it's not, insert comedian here. He said, it doesn't really matter who gets elected president. It really doesn't. It doesn't matter at all, because what happens is you get sworn in at the White House. You know, there's applause, and you kiss your wife, or in Hillary's case, you kiss your husband. And then Secret Service takes you inside the White House, right in the very back in the basement, to a very secret room. They sit you down, and they show you a tape of the Kennedy assassination. And then they flip, the lights on and say, any questions? So it doesn't really matter who the president is.
That's the one thing that's always fascinated me about the presidency. Well, it's two things. The second thing is whether Trump would actually live in the White House, or if he would actually, like, stay in his hotel in D.C. Like, I figured that'd be up for debate. But the other thing is, like, when you become president, that's – you have to learn everything. You have to learn all the things they don't tell us about, like, aliens. You know, it's the coolest, but at the same time, it's like, that's when the presidential candidates get their, like, security briefings, I'm surprised they don't walk out of that room, like, openly weeping and clutching the blanket they had as a child about all of the things in the world that we're not privy to, because they don't want to scare the populace into rioting and looting and hoarding water and canned goods. And now they've got to know about it. Like, I don't know if I can handle that if I was walking into that room.
I don't know how they all, and maybe they do, I don't know how all leaders like that of any country, armed with that type of information and knowing how, you know, how your decisions can affect millions and millions of people, how they're not all in therapy. God, I would be. When I need to make a decision on what to have for lunch, it's an existential crisis.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
Making decisions like that. Good
Lord. And that's why, like, when, you know, George W. Bush went into office, he looked like James Brolin, and he walked out and he looked like his dad. Like, all these guys just age exponentially.
Look at Obama.
Exactly. Right.
You know what, though? You know, too? You know, it's a great – this would be a good one for Puck Daddy to do. Pictures of general managers when they started with certain teams and when they finished with certain teams.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Dude, that would be a great one.
Curiously, I think Lou's looked the same when he came on board with the Devils in 87 to now.
Lou looked that way when he was 16.
like in the Austin Powers movies when Dr. Evil as a kid still looked like Dr. Evil.
That's Lou Lamoriello. He has never not looked like that. That's Lou since puberty.
All right, so you got to get out of here. What do you have coming up on Sportsnet?
The 30 show, which is a big sort of tour around the NHL, and then we've got four games on the network tonight, so doing intermissions for all of them, juggle, and finishing up with the Vancouver Canucks game tonight, which this is awesome. Like, the Vancouver phenomenon to me is such a freak. 3-0 and have never led in regulation. It's glorious.
Yeah,
it really is glorious what's happened in Vancouver. So. Patrice Bergeron makes his return tonight for the Boston Bruins. He'll take on Wish's New Jersey Devils, coming off the big win against the Anaheim Ducks. Speaking of Anaheim, who will they lose to tonight? Oh, yeah, the Philadelphia Flyers. Braden Schenn, who's back, will be playing on the top line. Mm-hmm. It'll be Gibson versus Mason. So all this and more love on Twitter from me, for the Colorado Avalanche, who are playing tonight.
I'm going to be all over the Twitters tonight, too, because it's my night to work. But what do you have doing anything this weekend on the big old network or no?
Doing Maple Leafs game pre and post on the radio on Saturday. I'm doing this same shift that I'm doing tonight on Friday, and then Sunday I'm off, and then back on the TVs on Monday. Got to do something really cool last night for the Leafs Winnipeg Jets game that we're going to be doing consistently, which is doing prospect reports when my list comes out every month.
Nice.
Top 31. So that was a good little launch yesterday. Me and Darren and Sammy Cosentino throwing it around, and So it's been a busy week. That's why I haven't returned any of your texts, Greg. Want to shame me publicly here on the podcast?
No, I'm not going to shame anything publicly. You're a very busy man. I just love that. I love where our lots in life are right now, where you're tasked with keeping and maintaining a master list ranking of NHL prospects, and I spent 15 minutes today ranking my top 10 Mystery Science Theater 3000 episodes.
I just got a tip from my guy in Sweden too about one kid who I don't want to say too much, but is that there's surprise another hotshot Swede who's really popped this year so far after Jacob Larsson took his spot with Anaheim. Anyway, there's your little tease, but there's a new big Swede on the horizon. Who kind of reminds a lot of people of Sammy Vatanen. I've said too much already.
So it sounds like he's going to have a ridiculously large contract within 5 years of entering the league. All right. Well, thank you.
There you
Merrick.
Go. What do you got going on? What do you got going
on? Oh, the usual BS. I got something on Vegas's coaching search coming on Puck Daddy soon. I got my yayas out with the Bobby Hull Reputation Protection Society stepping up and trying to separate the player from the person this morning. Jesus, I can't anymore. I don't get it. I don't get this false equivocation of like, we all have flaws as people. It's true. I mean,
I
think some of us probably haven't beaten our ex-wives in the head with a, you know, steel heeled shoe or openly praised Adolf Hitler. I don't think a lot of us have done that, but I one time did jump a turnstile at the subway. So I mean, you know, I probably shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame either. You're right.
Parked illegally last week. So yeah, me and Bobby Hull are cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, that's right. Oh God. But you know what's amazing? Because I was writing about that this morning. I was thinking to myself, you know, like you to your credit, I think we're well ahead of the curve on that.
On Bobby?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been talking. It's funny too, because I can't, and I don't know why I did it. Maybe it's just that old school protect thing. But I know I came. When I first mentioned, I think in the first season of the podcast,
you kind of danced around it.
I kind of danced around who it was, and then I think it was after 2 years, I just kind of said, "Ah, screw it, it's Bobby Hull." But I mean, everyone's sort of. I think, and it's not as if it's secret information. I mean, this is all stuff that was out, you know, when he was going through his divorce. This is all stuff that was public. So I don't know why I said, "Well, there's one superstar in the Hall of Fame that you know, blah blah blah." But yeah, no, I can't. I can't do it. Like there was one time too on Hockey Night Radio when I was doing it on Sirius and my producer had booked Bobby Hull and I just said, no. Like I'm not going to do it. And the best part about that was, the day that he was supposed to be on, I ended up being sick that day. And so they rebooked him and the guy that filled in for me said, I'm not doing the show if Bobby Hull's on.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. He, you know, it's funny, like one of the things that was said about it this morning in the Winnipeg media was sort of like, I think it was Lawless who wrote sort of like, you know, we live in an era of, you know, more scrutiny and everything with media and social media. And I'm like, no, I mean, it's not scrutiny. It's sunshine on these things that used to lurk in the dark corners of our society, wherein if a player pointed a loaded shotgun at his wife, although that may have been protected by the media in 1978, today it wouldn't be. And we should be happy about that. We should be glad that this is not something that's no longer covered up by people for whatever reason. I don't get it. It's one thing to look at society and be like, well, oh God, you got this guy fired because he made a misogynist tweet. And it's another thing to look at today's society and be like, oh great, we're finally talking about domestic violence in serious terms. I don't get it. The whole thing was just a giant pile of false equivocation, I thought.
Yeah. No, I know. And you know what? nice seeing Hedberg and Nelson out there. I remember them fondly. I remember the hotline like it was. I mean, you know, I was a big WHA fan when I was a kid, and I didn't miss not seeing Bobby Hull out there. Totally fine with it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, honor him with his spot. That's fine. But all you need to know about this is in the fact that he didn't show up, because he knows what's up. He knows that he has got this anchor around him now, and rightfully so. I don't think in this case you can separate the personal from the professional, and that goes for a number of guys. I mean, goddamn, Kirby Puckett's one of the most beloved players in the history of sports until everything came out about him. And now that's part of his story, too, and that's just how it works. Well, I'm glad we ended on a high note. Merrick, we'll talk next week, buddy.
All right, be safe. Who you got coming up next, Wish?
Oh, I don't know. Like, let me think about this. Who could I throw on that could possibly equal the excitement of getting Jeff Merrick on his own podcast? I guess I probably would have to talk to someone like the great one, Wayne Gretzky. 99 Stories of the Game is the new book by Wayne Gretzky, along with Christy McLennan Day, published by Putnam. It's a big, thick book, and it's filled with cool stories about Gretzky, but also stories that Gretzky wanted to tell about the history of hockey. And so earlier on Thursday, I made my way to NHL HQ here in Manhattan. It's above the NHL store, where there was a rather elephantine line of fans ready to queue up and get Gretzky's autograph on their books. Went upstairs to a giant room filled with books that Gretzky was going to autograph for various people, and got some time with Wayner, me and him, discussing the game. And I particularly went into this with one thing in mind, which was a thing that I thought about and discovered at the World Cup of Hockey press conference he did with Bettman with regard to the centennial celebration. And the stories he was telling about going to the Hockey Hall of Fame incognito and looking around, and the stories he was telling about when he was a kid and the memorabilia he used to have. And it was this realization about Gretzky that I never had before, which is that he is just a giant hockey nerd, a giant hockey geek, a giant hockey grown-up hockey fan who just so happened to have the greatest skill set in the history of hockey and became the greatest player in the history of hockey, although he would tell you it's Gordy. And so I wanted to kind of approach the interview from that aspect, and from that aspect, I think it went pretty well. Learned a little thing or two about Wayne and his approach to the game and what he was as a young kid, as a fan, and getting into sort of like how all of that history in a roundabout way informs us about Gretzky in ways that the books about Gretzky don't necessarily inform us about him. But I did want to mention that at one point during this interview, you'll hear me try to end it. Because, like, you get 10 minutes with the dude, and I was trying to, like, allow him to finish all of the book signings he needed to do. Because he basically stopped. He, like, signed a book, then he stopped and talked to me for 10 minutes, which was real sweet of him. But I felt like he was there for other purposes as well, and I felt like I was keeping him from doing it. But then he kind of tells me to keep talking to him, so I asked him about Austin Matthews and a bunch of other stuff, too, for a little bit. But that's the weird transitional part. It was kind of like when you were watching The Tonight Show back in the day, and the comedian would do well enough where he got to sit next to Johnny. That's how I felt. I felt like Wayne felt like the interview was going well enough that he and I could continue talking while he did this other task. So that made me happy. Anyway, Wayne Gretzky, the great one, talking about, amongst other things, whether or not he actually likes being called the great one. And listen to this. Enjoy it. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Let me ask you, so I was at the World Cup when we were talking about the centennial stuff, and I was fascinated, because I never put two and two together before you became the player you are. You were kind of a hockey nerd growing up. You're kind of a fan, right?
Well, I probably would categorize it as one of the biggest hockey fans in the world. you know, as a kid, the Pittsburgh Penguins used to do training camp in those days when they expanded to 12 teams. The Penguins were in Brantford. The New York Rangers were in Kitchener. I think the Boston Bruins were in Oshawa. Anyway, they would come in for about 21, 22 days, and those were the days we had 6-week training camp. And the best time of my life was every year my dad would let me miss a couple of days of school to go down and watch the Penguins practice all day. I went to my first NHL game when I was 7 when my grandmother was sat in the very last row of Maple Leaf Gardens, and I thought it was the greatest day of my life. And so I've always had this dream and goal of wanting to play in the National Hockey League, and whether it's following guys on TV, collecting hockey cards, walking around the Hockey Hall of Fame, to me it's the greatest game in the world, and I got to meet so many wonderful people in it, and play in some great cities, and play in some beautiful and great historic arenas, and I was so proud and privileged to be part of the National Hockey League. Simple as that.
When you told that story about you and your son at the Hall of Fame,
it
was a great story, by the way.
I know, it's funny,
it really kind of brought it home that, like, here is you, who's done it all, who's seen it all, who's half your shit's in the Hall of Fame right now. But, like, the idea of you walking through those halls and still being in awe of some of the items in there is kind of it's impressive.
Yeah,
I think for us commoners.
You know, all the way back to the Canada Cups of 81. It was such a thrill for me to play with Perreault and Lafleur and Robinson and Dennis Potvin. But what was even more amazing was to sit in the Montreal Canadiens locker room for each and every practice and every game, because that's where our home building was that year. And so for me, the history of the game is still the greatest part of our game, other than the players who played in the game. So when I get an opportunity, I periodically go to the Hall of Fame. When I was a kid, I used to go. It used to be down at the old CNE exhibition. I'd go all the time, especially in the summertime. I'd go for hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, friends and buddies and family, they would go on rides and all that kind of stuff. And I could just stand in the Hall of Fame and stare. I could never get enough of it. So I've always had that thrill. And even today now, I'll periodically sneak in there, just put a hat on, a pair of sunglasses, buy a ticket, keep my head down, and walk around, and I just stand there. And, you know, I don't look at my stuff very much. I mean, I know it's there, but I like looking at the old stuff that's in there, the Montreal Canadian guys, the Gordie Howes, the Oars. I can't get enough of it. It's the greatest game in the world.
And that's one of the reasons you wrote this, right? It's sort of it's a history book for a different generation to kind of get into it.
Yeah, and it's sort of a, obviously, there's the first component of it is more based upon fact-finding and research of the game itself from 1916 through the 40s and 50s to a point where when I'm 6 and 7 and 8 where I'm realizing about the game of hockey as a kid growing up dreaming about the players and about the teams and the arenas to then the point where I play the game to the point where I retired. So it's sort of a four-part puzzle or segue in the book in the sense that people will probably learn some things about the game they didn't know. They probably didn't realize that we started with, like, football and basketball. We had two halves and not three periods. it was changed for financial reasons, basically.
Beer sales, right?
And so it was business-orientated from the get-go.
I've read books about you. I read Brunt's book. I read some other books about you. Have you read them? Do you read the books after they come out that are about you?
No, I really don't. And
I don't blame you.
Yeah, it's it's not something that sort of overexcites me, to say the least, because I'm the guy that's lived it.
Yeah.
And that's why in this book, it's really not a Wayne Gretzky's book. It's obviously some of it has to be about me because of the 87 Canada Cup and winning the Stanley Cup and things like that. But what I really wanted to do with the book is talk a little bit, as little about Wayne Gretzky as possible. I know people are probably sick of hearing about me, and I'm sick of hearing about me. but the game is bigger than any individual, and the sport is bigger than any individual. And I wanted to talk about the great players that we've had in the game and the great organizations in the dynasties and the arenas, you know, just you know, how the history of some of those arenas and how great they were and yet how bad some of them were. I mean, Boston Garden was, you know, one of the greatest buildings ever, but it was the worst place to play hockey. I mean, that's not a knock. That's
right.
You know, in the 20s, I'm sure it was a great arena.
Yeah, right.
But
Nassau Coliseum was great in the 80s.
And going into the old Buffalo Odd and, you know, that's what gave the history of our game. That's, you can't we can never take away the historic part of our game, and that includes the teams, the players, the arenas, and the trophies for that matter. I mean, we have the greatest barrage of trophies, from the Art Ross to the Norris to the Jack Adams to ultimately the Stanley Cup. We have things that no other sport has, and that's what makes our sport so special.
I'm going to get philosophical on you for a second. Mm. Is telling the story of hockey indirectly telling the story of Wayne Gretzky, though? What made you who you are?
Yeah, maybe in a lot of ways, because I always say to kids whenever parents say, will you talk to my son, or somebody will say, do you talk to my daughter? I say the same things that I would tell my kids. It doesn't matter what you do. You know, you can be an artist, you can be an athlete, you can be a doctor, but if you have a passion to do that, what you want to do, there's no limit to what you can accomplish. Mm-hmm. Because if you have that passion, and I tell this all the time, if you have that passion, you're going to put in the extra time, right. You're going to put in the extra work, you're going to prepare better. Because as parents will come up to me and say, will you tell my son, who's 8 years old, how many hours a day you used to practice? And I always say the same thing. I said, I didn't. I said, I don't even know, because I just did it what I loved. Right. And it was probably 9-10 hours a day, but I didn't look at it that way. It was like, okay, and especially at 13 and 14, when other things come into your life, or friends wanted to go to the mall, they wanted to go to movies, and my first instinct always was, you know, I'm going to go in the backyard and skate for a few hours. I don't want to go to a movie.
It's not work if you love it, right?
And so I always try to encourage kids, no matter what you're doing, to make sure you give it your fullest commitment, because if you have a passion, and when I was 15, and over the years, my path and Gordy's path, we crossed quite a bit from the time I met him at 10, to the time at 15, I played with his youngest son, Murray, who was 60.
Yeah.
And we played junior B hockey together. And I remember saying to Murray one day, and we were talking, and it was near the end of the year, and I knew my love and my passion was, geez, ultimately I want to play for Detroit, and I want to play in the NHL. And I knew that at a younger age. And I remember sitting and talking with Murray one day, and Murray said to me, you know, this is my last year of hockey. I go, what do you mean it's your last year? Gordy, house son can't play till he's only 16, you know what I mean? And he said to me, he said, I'll never forget. He said, you know what, Wayne, my passion is I want to be a doctor. And I'm going to be the Gordy Howe of doctors. I'm going to be the best doctor I can be.
Yeah.
And he went on to become a doctor and loves his life. And so everybody's path is different to what you're going to be at the end of the day. But I know he worked as hard at becoming a good doctor as his dad did to become a great player.
Last one for you. Mm-hmm. Were you ever uncomfortable with the Great One as a nickname? Did you ever wish it was something else?
You know, it's one of those things where the guy who gave me the nickname was so proud of it. I like to choke him. his name is John Herbert, and he wrote for the London Free Press, a little town outside of Brantford. He gave it to me when I was 10 years old.
10, huh?
10 years old.
Was that probably 2 years older than when Connor got his first nickname?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I was at, my son and I were at dinners one night at Charles Barkley and his wife, and we were having dinner, and Charles said, looked up and said, will you pass the Great One the salt? And she reached over to pass it to Charles, and I, what is that? He goes, at home they call me the Great One. I said, you can have the name everywhere, Charles.
Does that mean by default you become the round mound of rebound?
Yeah, you can take it.
All right, Wayne, thanks for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
You can ask me a couple more if you want.
Oh, you got to sign some books, man.
No, sorry, just talk.
All right, man. Right, well, while we're talking, let's talk about Austin then.
Yeah.
You famously went to L.A. Yeah. You kind of planted the seed for a lot of kids out there to play. What do you think about Austin potentially being that kid for Scottsdale and places in Arizona?
I hope so. You know, he's a wonderful young man. I think that he's in a right situation as far as the team, has good leadership and good management and a good coach that are going to guide him through these younger years. And B, and just as important, it's a younger group of players now, and the organization knows that this is the guy we're going to basically build this team around to ultimately win the Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like anything, you got to be a little bit lucky. And I say this all the time. I went to the right team, the right players, the right coach, in the right era. And it looks like from afar right now that he's in the right situation, and I'm sure he's going to excel and have a great career.
Yeah. And I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the centennial and things like that. First of all, is it good to get back with the league?
Yeah, you know, it's the greatest game in the world, and the league's always been good to me, and the games was great to me. When they asked me to come on board, the reality is I was going to go to all those events anyway, and for them to give me the privilege and the honor of being an ambassador is a thrill. So I don't... I don't think of it as work. I think of it as exciting. It's great to be around hockey. It's wonderful that we're heading into our 100th centennial year, 100th anniversary of the league. And it's just, it's been, I'm thrilled.
All right, last one.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about the speed of the game now.
Yeah.
What could an 18-year-old Wayne Gretzky do in this league that's got a premium on speed and no red line and all that other stuff?
Well, listen, you know, it's always going to be hard to compare eras. You know, it's a different game today than what we came into in 1980. Mm-hmm. You know, the players are bigger and they're faster, they're stronger, the coaching, the equipment, all that goes hand in hand. But, you know, the one thing that I did have that probably would have been the positive of me playing in this era is that your hockey sense doesn't change, whether it's 1980 or 2016.
Right.
So
right.
I would have relied way more on my hockey sense than anything else because the game is so fast.
Indeed.